Good morning. You are listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'll be joined by my co-host, Celeste Carey, and we are so glad that you are here. Let me remind you that this is a community radio station based here in Portland, but you are also listening to us on 91.9 in Hood River, 100.7 in Corvallis, 90.7 in Portland, and on the World Wide Web, KBOO.FM. This is Monday morning, and October is the what is the date? The 25th of October, and we are so glad that you are here. It is fall here in Portland. After a relatively mild early fall, the fall weather has come completely. So for the past few days, we've had rain and wind, and oh, it's all so normal. Well, this morning, we're going to continue our ongoing conversation about the economy and what's right with it, what's wrong with it. We are all in the midst of an election cycle, and joining us this morning to help decipher some of this madness is Doug Henwood, who is the editor of Left Business Observer. He is the host of Behind the News, a show he has hosted since 1996 on WBAI in New York. He has written extensively several books on the economy and Wall Street and the doing some exploring about the American ruling class. We're here this morning to talk about our economy, what's right, what's wrong, and where do we go from now. Mr. Henwood, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Good morning.
How are you today?
All right. I'm trying to think of what's right with the economy. I'm not able to come up with anything at the moment.
Not quite yet. So, you know, we're in the midst of the election cycles. Democrats are going all crazy, and we're wondering what's going to happen. So we thought we would have this conversation this morning to get some of your insight in terms of what the public has been talking about. And I thought we might begin by you just sharing your views on what the Democrats are doing correctly or the Republicans are doing correctly. And what do you think is going to happen after November 2nd?
I think we've got several things operating. First is that it's kind of normal for the incumbent party to lose seats in the midterm elections, so that would be an expected result. The second thing is the economy is really crummy, and that intensifies that normal result. So voters tend to blame the incumbent party for what's going wrong with the economy or credit it for what's going right, even if the incumbent party had nothing to do with it. So that's strike two against the Democrats, and I think strike three is that they've done a very, very poor job of not only making policy but explaining what they've done. I think the stimulus package, which was not ideal, was not the way I would have designed it, but I think it did arrest economic decline and keep us all from absolute Armageddon, and they've done a very poor job of explaining that. In fact, a lot of Democrats are like kind of acting apologetic and try to distance themselves from it. You know, I just happened to be listening to Reagan's first inaugural address the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed. Well, first of all, that guy was very good at what he did, as noxious as what he did was. But he was very good at making popular arguments. And he said, we can't go back to the failed economic policies of the 1970s. Times are tough now, but things will get better. Obama has never really made that kind of argument with the strength or clarity that Reagan did, and in part because I think he does not feel that he wants to make a break with a lot of the economic policies of the past. He's rather tied to them. So I think he's done a very poor sales job, and a lot of the policies have been very bank-friendly, not worker-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So he's selling what is an imperfect package very poorly.
I would like to touch about that because you mentioned two things. One, they've done probably a crummy job with the economy. And second, you said that in terms of explaining the economy. Some people have said, I was talking to someone just before we came on air, and he said, you know, we hear these people who are boohooing the Democrats and saying, well, if they were better able to have nice sound bites, things would be so much better. But I want to, I think that might be part of the problem, but perhaps as you hinted, their fix wasn't as radical enough, or as you hinted, a clear break with the past. If you were had the ears of the economists, and what would you tell the Democrats how to what they should have done better?
Well, they didn't really do enough to create jobs, and didn't really focus on the unemployment problem enough. The obsession with the health care package, I think, was a mistake at that point. I don't really think it was a great health care package anyway. Mm-hmm. With that aside, I think they should have focused much more on job creation. Most Americans got a tax cut from Obama and the Democrats. Most Americans don't even realize that. The stimulus package should have contained more direct job creation measures. There's too much indirect stuff, a home buyer tax credit and things like that, investment tax credits. Those don't work very well, and they don't really work quickly enough. If there had been more direct efforts at federal procurement, more infrastructure investment, that would have helped. And also, there's been too little attention on long-term economic development. Now, we have a very serious long-term economic problem. We can talk about that later if you like. Mm-hmm. But I would say that there is basically no leading dynamic sector in the economy to propel things forward. We have nothing like basic industrialization in the 19th century or suburbanization was in the 1950s and 1960s. Some single theme that really is driving a lot of other economic activity. We have nothing like that now. Even in the late 90s, we had technology. A lot of that was a bubble. A lot of that was inflated. But there was something going on there. Now we really have nothing. The most recent economic boom was driven by a crazy, unsustainable housing bubble. So now we need something new, important, and big to drive us forward. Green technology could do that. Clean energy, environmentally sensitive technologies could do that. The Democrats have done no more than pay a little lip service to that and throw in a few bucks, but nothing on the scale that's absolutely necessary. The stimulus package actually contained energy R&D subsidies, about $5 billion through the Energy Department. That was rated to pay for the Cash for Clunkers program. So it wasn't enough to start with, and they're not. And then it was cut back as time went on. Now, I understand that it's hard to get this stuff through Congress. Republicans think that trains are for pansies, and you know, they'll red bait, and God knows what. You know, it's a very substantial uphill battle, no doubt about it. But they really didn't try very hard. That Obama's, rather than making that kind of both political and rhetorical break with the past that Reagan engineered so successfully, by not doing that, but instead by trying to be bipartisan and cooperative and all that nonsense, they've engineered a major electoral and even economic disaster.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. Join us also on the web at www.kboo.fm. And we've got our email connections up and running. You can email us your comments, your concerns, your questions at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Or you can come through our site at the KBOO website on More Talk Radio. Good morning, Doug. This is Celeste. I have a couple of questions with regard to the fact that you think the stimulus plan that we had was ill-aimed. With regard to the fact that the Democrats were not assertive and visionary enough, you said, with creating opportunities for more jobs as opposed to more tax cuts. What about the in-house fighting we had that really seemed to necessitate Obama's attempts at bipartisanship, ownership of whatever plan they had? Because it seemed as though some of the key parts he had wanted to do kept being undercut.
Well, I don't know. I saw early in his tenure, I saw an op-ed piece written by somebody who used to work for Johnson, Lyndon Johnson. And it was, what would Johnson be doing right now? And with the way Johnson would have worked Congress would have been a combination of carrots and sticks. He would have twisted arms. Mm-hmm. He would have bought people off with projects in their districts. He would have, like, brought them to the White House and asked them how their grandchildren were doing. There was a whole array of, you know, combination of force and seduction that Johnson used to work things through Congress. Obama didn't do any of that. He was very distant, in fact, a lot of stuff with Congress. And then he didn't really approach the public in any way the way Reagan did. It was just no attempt to persuade the public the importance of making a break with the past, of having a new agenda, of really explaining what went wrong with the economy, and I think part of the reason for that is that he did not really want to break with the power of Wall Street. You know, you look back in 1936, Roosevelt gave a speech in Madison Square Garden in which he said that never in our history have the forces of wealth and power be so arrayed against a president. They hate me, and I welcome their hatred. Mm-hmm. You can't imagine Obama saying something like that. He wants the love of people on Wall Street. You know, he says things like Jamie Dimon, the chair of J.P. Morgan Chase, is a savvy businessman. That is not really the way that the powerful Democratic presidents who really changed things, like Roosevelt and Johnson. And I know there are plenty of things wrong with these guys and plenty of things wrong with Johnson in particular, but they were able really to control the political discourse and control the agenda. Obama never even tried. He came into office with a fairly large mandate, with a tremendous amount of popular enthusiasm, with a very energized base. He didn't really work with that. He immediately went to work trying to court Republicans. They had a large congressional majority that they never really took advantage of. Now, yes, there were divisions within his party, but a skilled politician could have managed them. He didn't even, he is a skilled politician in some sense, but a very intelligent man who knows policy, is very impressive in lots of ways, but in this kind of bare-knuckled politics that it takes to get things done, he just didn't even try. And he didn't even try to use the legendary bully pulpit of the presidency to change the way people talk and think.
Do you think the fact that he hired a lot of folks from the Clinton administration also validates your assertion that basically he just didn't make that clean break?
Yeah, well, he appointed them, so it wasn't like they imposed themselves on him.
Right.
And he also made the point of appointing a couple of Republicans to his cabinet. Why did he need to do that? He won a large convincing majority of votes, and he was succeeding a Republican who was leaving office in disgrace. Why the need to conciliate with these people instead of stepping all over them? These are people who deserve to be stepped on brutally. One thing about the Clintons, though, there are a lot of things wrong with the Clintons, but they were partisan. The Republicans hated them, and they fought Republicans in turn. I think had Hillary won, I don't think we would have seen these efforts at bipartisanship. She would have been a much more partisan president. There is a structural issue with the Democrats. They are essentially a party of business that has to pretend otherwise for electoral reasons. Mm-hmm. So that sometimes ties them in the knots, and they act act compromised, or what people think of as compromised or weak. But in fact, is they're really trying to serve two masters, a popular base and their business paymasters. So that is a fundamental problem. But even so, Wall Street, when Obama was inaugurated, was deeply discredited. Everybody hated him. He could have worked with that. But look at the financial regulation that he crafted. Mm-hmm. Very weak stuff. Effort all around. The health care bill. You have people like Daschle saying they wanted to keep the health insurance companies on board with reform. Yes. The health insurance companies are the problem. Why keep these guys on board with reform? If they like what you're doing something wrong. There's much too much of that sort of thing for the last couple of years. And, I think a lot of the American public is pretty conservative. There's no doubt about it. It's there's a popular opinion is very suspicious of government and all this. We're very familiar with hearing all these stories, and there's some truth to them. But also someone in the office of the president could make a difference. He's got a lot of power, a lot of prestige, especially when you come into office with a large majority succeeding a discredited, disgraced old regime, and they didn't take advantage of it. They were conciliatory with people who did not deserve to be conciliated.
Now, at the end of in the middle of Ronald Reagan's first term, he seemed to have been, although he came in and was able to rally his troops, his party, as you suggested, most parties in midterm elections suffered a defeat, and people were saying that he will be a one-term president, possibly. Apparently, we know what happened. Is there enough umption within the Obama administration to make a corrective force if and when the Republicans take control of the Congress?
Well, I think that's quite possible, I think, for two reasons. One is that it's quite possible the economy will recover. There's a kind of a pattern between the two parties, a different pattern between the two parties. Republicans tend to have recessions early in their term and then have recoveries late in them. And then the public only remembers the last good year and forgets the bad first 2 or 3 years. The Democrats tend to have good early years and then have a recession towards the end, and the public only remembers the bad stuff. So maybe with the recession happening so early in his term, we could see a recovery by 2012, and he would then be credited with the turnaround and get reelected on that. Second of all, I think that it's quite likely Republicans will take over at least the House, and possibly the Senate. Well, I think that's a bigger stretch. There are going to be a bunch of lunatics. I mean, there are going to be some people elected in a Republican sweep who will be completely insane and will do absolutely nutty things while in office. And I think there's quite a great possibility the public will be revolted by this display. Remember 1994, when there was that, during Clinton's first term, when the Republicans took over Congress in that midterm election. A year later, the Republicans had led to the shutdown of the government and great disgrace, and then led to Clinton's reelection by a large margin in 96. So it's quite possible we might see something like that, because you know, the Republican Party now, you know, I've been very critical of the Democrats in the 15 minutes we've been talking, but the Republican Party is a completely insane formation. The stuff these people say is just otherworldly.
We'll come back to them, because not only do we have a couple of callers, but I want to talk about some of the things that folks are not saying in the midst of this midterm election, such as elements of the economy that are really important to a great deal of us, like Social Security. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metropolitan area, 91.9 if you're in the Hood River area. In the Willamette Valley, it's 100.7 on the web. It's KBOO.FM. You can join in the conversation online at moretalkradio@gmail.com or at our KBOO website and click on More Talk Radio, or the old-fashioned low-tech way by telephone, 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our first caller who's been holding. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for the show. Thank you for the guest. It's got a similar style as me. I get all excited, get into a rant, and lay it down hard. But, yeah, there are solutions, and there is hope. And I think one thing is to not forget the House of Representatives, because if you look at the long, 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 long list of wonderful stuff they've done in this short time, then, of course, it goes to the Senate to die. But I think there's hope there, and I'll keep on moving on. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Henwood. Let's call it what it is. It's a new deal for Wall Street, not Main Street, and also wondering also if you might, I've read your books, Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom, and also I've read The End of the New Economy. And one of the questions I have would be, David Corton is someone who's out there with a pretty harsh critique of Wall Street, but it's sort of a kind of a corny populism, and you're really good at skewering that sort of populism. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that, as well as the whole flash crash issue. In your book, Wall Street, you talk about the front-running and the specialists and how that's actually now become electronic, how there's supercomputers in New Jersey that skim off percentage points of stock trades, like 70% of all trades now are done electronically. So if you could touch on any of that stuff, I'd really appreciate it, Mr. Henwood.
Well, the flash crash stuff is kind of arcane, but I think I'll just say that Wall Street was always really a game mostly for insiders, but it seems to have become even more so now that the real gains are going to the very core of Wall Street. And you know, if you look at some, like the private equity and hedge fund stuff, it's the managers of those funds who make all the money. Even the institutional investors are not making money. This has become, I think, this is American OS, U.S. OS had plutocratic tendencies, but I think we've just become largely a plutocracy that's run for the benefit of the richest 1%. They're the ones who've been gaining most of the income of the last 30 years. Almost all the benefits of economic growth have gone to the top 1 or 2% of the population for the last several decades. While there was always elements of great inequality in this country, I think it's just become almost unprecedented, the degree to which it's just become a game for absolute insiders. And it's going to take a lot to break that hold. It's going to take a really serious popular mobilization of the sort that we're not seeing right now. I envy the French out in the streets kicking up a fuss, but we're not doing anything remotely like that right now.
Mr. Henwood, that kind of gets to a larger point. One of the things that gets tossed around a lot in our society is who is productive and who is not productive. And I think it can't be overstated enough that these forces of Wall Street represent the most unproductive elements in the society, and yet they constantly badger the true wealth creators, the workers and the army of unemployed. They constantly badger the truly productive forces in the population as having a sense of entitlement or wanting something for nothing. Your whole book, Wall Street, isn't it about basically how Wall Street serves no productive function whatsoever? It's basically a large casino. They don't even raise capital for companies or anything like that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, most of what Wall Street does is just collect money that's generated elsewhere, and they are very arrogant about it. You know, they think that because they make so much money, they contribute a lot. But in fact, when you look at what they contribute, it's next to nothing. And for the last couple of decades, really, they've just been sucking money out of the productive sector. Corporations have been paying large wads of money to their shareholders. Consumers, households have been paying lots and lots of money to service their debts. And all this money has been flowing to a very, very narrow group of people at the very top of our society, most of whom work on Wall Street. Well, Wall Street, you know, has always been the best-paid sector of American society since the statistics began in the late 1920s, but their advantage over the rest of us has just expanded in the last 10 or 20 years. It's remarkable. They just, as the caller mentioned, most corporate investment is funded by corporations through their own cash flow. They don't really have to turn to outside markets to raise a lot of the money. So what Wall Street does is it just like this gigantic parasitical operation that has grown up around a very small productive core, and now they're just getting fatter and fatter on the work and the income that the rest of us generate.
Well, thank you, caller, for your call. And speaking of the productivity of the average person and getting rich, or at least being able to be sustained by what you've worked and earned, I understand that the Democrats made a pledge not to touch Social Security. Now, I find that really interesting because you're not hearing about this very much as a campaign issue. So can you tell us a little bit about why this pledge? Was this more grandstanding and not anything of substance? And why is Social Security not being the issue that it really should be in terms of its stability and why it needs to be protected?
You know, about a week or 10 days ago, about 200 Democrats signed a pledge. They would not go along with any efforts to cut back on Social Security, to raise a retirement age or cut benefits or privatize the system either in whole or part. Now, that's very good news, although that's, you know, 200 is less than half of Congress, so I'm not sure they could block anything that the rest of Congress wanted to do. But what inspired this was that the president appointed a commission several months ago that is supposed to report on ways to reduce the deficit over the longer term. They're going to report on December 1st. Mm-hmm. And come up with a series of recommendations of what to do about it. December 1st will be after the election, but before the new Congress takes office, so I suspect that this lame duck Congress can't do anything about it, so it's going to be up to the next gang to do something about these recommendations. It's virtually certain that they're going to recommend cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The co-chair of the commission, Alan Simpson, the Republican from Wyoming, former senator, and he was appointed by Obama, remember, has a long-standing enemy of Social Security. His goal has always been, for 20 years at least, to turn Social Security into a very minimal welfare program for the poor, and the rest of us could be left to fend for ourselves in retirement. That is the conservative ideal. I think that may be too extreme to get past right now, but I think that would be the long-term goal of a lot of people, not just the Republican Party, but in Wall Street, who would like to get their hands on Social Security money. If they could privatize the system, put it all into the stock market, or even part of it into the stock market, Wall Street stands to make lots of money off that. And I think a lot of Republicans and even some Democrats would be happy to go along with this scheme. Now, the projections that Social Security is going to have serious troubles in the coming decades come from the trustees of the Social Security system. They put out an annual set of projections. Also, the Congressional Budget Office does this as well. And they both project that the system is going to run out of money sometime in the next 20 or 30 years. The date varies depending upon when they do the projections.
But aren't these projections based on some really dire economic conditions that we're not in right now?
Well, we're in terrible economic conditions right
now.
Yes, but they're projecting that we're going to have 70 years of near depression rate of economic growth. Now, there are two things you can say about this. One is that that's very unlikely. We're not going to have 70 years of near depression, because there's no reason to believe that, because there's no historical precedent for anything like that. You know, the worst we had was 10 years of bad depression, but 10 years is not 70 years. The other thing is, if they really think this is true, then we've got a very serious economic problem that we need to talk about.
That's bigger than Social Security. Right.
And we're going to have a lot more problems than just Social Security. But even if you accept their projections as true, the magnitude of the Social Security problem that they project is actually quite manageable. It's not a dire thing. They're projecting a gap of roughly 1% of GDP or a little more. That's just since 2000, the military budget has increased by 3 or 4 percent of GDP. So now all we'd have to do is undo part of that military increase and shift it to Social Security, and Social Security has no problem. It's just, when we're talking about a problem of that magnitude, it's not worth talking about. So I think that all these expressions of alarm are really based on a desire to transform the system into a welfare program and to have people save more for themselves and have Wall Street manage more of those savings and eliminate this extremely successful and extremely popular public program. It's a longstanding desire of the right, and now a lot of Democrats have even come around to it. And it's really alarming and distressing, and we're not having any kind of serious debate about it in this political campaign season. And the timing of this Deficit Commission's report, I think, was deliberately designed to prevent that debate.
Well, two things you brought up.
A month after the election, you know, and that's clearly timed so that we're not going to be talking about that when we should be talking about it.
Two things you've brought up, Doug, I want to address. One is, why are the Democrats shifting now and getting on this wagon of wanting to privatize and pillage Social Security? And why are we not hearing as much as we should about the security of Social Security from the other folks besides yourself and David Corden that we've also had on the show? There's not enough hue and cry to show that Social Security is as stable as it is.
It's really very disturbing. My old congressman from Manhattan, Jerry Nadler, has been one of the few people in Congress who has actually spoken about this at length. But aside from some very liberal Democrats, you hear very little of this. You know, it used to be a core Democratic principle to defend Social Security vociferously and accuse the Republicans of trying to privatize it or loot it. But we're just not hearing that now. I think the reason is that Wall Street has been playing an ever-increasing role in the financing and agenda setting of the Democratic Party, and they're just not—they just don't want to go up against Wall Street. Now, the labor member of this deficit commission is Andy Stern, former president of the Service Employees Union. He has been buddying up to the Republicans of the commission, and has been talking about putting Social Security funds in the stock market, and this is the labor member of the
commission. That's right.
So we're in bad shape. But the labor member is really adopting a bunch of Republican talking points.
Andy Stern, you said?
Yeah.
SEIU?
Yep, that Andy Stern.
Wow.
Now, that's really frightening. So all of you folks who are labor members here, you need to get and start a groundswell from the bottom up and then call your labor leaders and let them know, please do not touch your Social Security. We do have some more callers online, and if you would like to join in the conversation, 503-231-8187, we'll gain you admission. Do that. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. And all these frantic attacks on candidates on each other, you don't hear any one of them speaking about progressive taxation, or in Oregon, where, and of course all over the nation, but in Oregon, where the market value of homes have declined, property taxes are still going up because there is a 3% statutory rate increase. And then I heard a very brief mention that since there was considered not an that there was no inflation, Social Security payments will not have their cost of living increase for the second year in a row. And then you hear that there is another request for $12 billion for the war on Pakistan just recently. And I wonder when somebody or any of these candidates will ever talk about these things, and you don't hear that. All you hear is attacks. There's no real information coming out of any candidate so far as I have been able to gather, and I would like to see anyone talking about that. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more with that. Because, another thing, aside from Social Security, that I'm talking about, we have two bloody expensive wars going on, and it's just not an election issue at all. It's just remarkable that people are not publicly talking about the fact that the Iraq War, although it's like officially semi-over, still is very expensive and very bloody, and now we're escalating in Afghanistan and getting deeply involved in Pakistan, spending lots of money and killing lots of people, and it's just, it's grotesque that we're not talking about it. The cost of the Iraq War is another thing that's, that's about on a par with what is projected to be the deficit in the Social Security system in the coming decades. So we can afford the Iraq War, but we can't afford Social Security. It's just remarkable. Now, I've run these numbers myself. I don't think that we can run very large deficits forever. I think we need to do it in the short term because the economy is so sick and we need the stimulus of deficits to turn it around. But, over the long term, it's not a good idea to borrow lots and lots of money and rack up big debts. But the way to balance the budget is to tax rich people and spend less on the military. There's plenty of money there to do that, but we just don't talk about that, much less do it.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. Our guest today is Doug Henwood, who is the editor of Left Business Observer. He's also the host of a weekly radio program on WBAI in New York. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. Our numbers here are 503-231-8032. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Your question or comment?
First, I wanted to restate a point that your guest made a bit ago, because I think it's incredibly important for people to understand. He made the comment that what's portrayed in the media about the Democratic Party being weak is, in fact, complicity on the part of the Democratic Party with the corrupt system. I think that's incredibly important. This weakness farce is just a way to distract people from what's really going on. So kudos for that. And also, on one of the other shows that KBOO runs on a regular basis, I heard Catherine Austin Fitz make the comment that people underestimate the power of shame. And certainly when you look at what Obama has been doing, and if you really take a hard look at what Clinton did, you see that basically they're scoundrels, and yet when they go out in public, they're surrounded by salivating groupies who just can't worship them enough. So I would like to ask your guest what he thinks is deficient in the American psyche that prevents us from calling a scoundrel a scoundrel.
Thank you, caller.
I wish I knew the answer to that. It's a sad thing, though. But you know, look, there are plenty of people out there who are happy to call Obama a scoundrel.
Yes.
But for all the wrong reasons.
Yes.
You know, they imagine he's some sort of Bolshevik, or he was born in Kenya, or that he's a secret Muslim, or all this crazy, offensive, repulsive stuff.
Or just old-fashioned stuff like he's a liar called out from congressional floor.
Yeah, I mean that's just that was unbelievable that. Some congressperson would say that, you know, it was just when he wasn't lying at that point, you know, he may lie at other points, but, you know, criticize the guy for the right reasons, not the wrong ones, please.
Well, let's talk about the Republicans. And you mentioned earlier in terms of some of the wacky fanatics who will probably hold federal offices after the election. What is your take on how perhaps the mainstream Republican Party will try to control the Tea Party types,
yes,
who are a very active part of their base right now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because in some ways the Tea Party people are just slightly more extreme versions of mainstream Republicans. But on the other hand, I think that a lot of the mainstream Republicans are afraid of that. That popular energy. They're afraid it might upset business as usual, which means, you know, doing the bidding of corporate America. The Tea Party people, who are, I don't think have a coherent philosophy of life, really, but are very energized. They just hate the establishment, and at least some of them do. I mean, it's a very varied phenomenon. It's hard to say exactly who they are or what they want.
Well, they seem to have a hodgepodge of leanings, everything,
yeah,
from very fiscal conservative to libertarian leanings, and, you know, in terms of less law, less government, less laws on my life. And so it is kind of hard to pinpoint them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, some of them are crazy racists. I think some of them just want to go back to a 19th-century sized government. I mean, you know, some of them are living on a different planet. It's it's a wide array of people, but I think that the Republican Party really essentially wants to run the government for the benefit of corporate America, just like the Democratic Party does. They have different shades and different constituencies and different styles and different popular bases, but you know, there's a certain joint agreement on the essential virtues of the Fortune 500 and Wall Street, and I think some of the Tea Party people would not be comfortable with that complicity. But it's interesting that someone, I can't remember who said this, but they said that the Republicans like their base, the Democrats are afraid of their base. There's some truth to that. Democrats are really afraid of their most most enthusiastic voters because they would push them to do things they don't really want to do. I think a lot of Republicans would be happy to cut the budget, and cut Medicare, and privatize lots of things, and you know, just let rich people get richer. That's certainly an overlap between the mainstream Republicans and the Tea Party folks. But I think there's a certain mania to the Tea Party people that would upset your average corporate lobbyist.
You're listening to KBOO, More Talk Radio. We'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes,
you're
on the air.
Mr. Henwood, I almost forgot to ask. I have to admit that when Bear Stearns was going under in March of 08, and then when Lehman Brothers went under in September of 08, I have to admit, I was actually kind of excited. I mean, I think I had a kind of incorrect Marxist analysis. I was waiting for capitalism to finally destroy itself. Like, what's the old joke? Marxists have successfully predicted 3 of the last 11 recessions, or 11 of the last 3 recessions, or something,
yeah,
like that. I just botched that completely. But anyway, I was hoping maybe you could clear this up for me. Like, why should we be happy that we averted Armageddon for our ecology, for our working standards? I was actually hoping for a financial Armageddon because I believe this system is so destructive and so catastrophic in its normal everyday functioning. So could you please explain that a little bit?
Yeah, and instead of averted, it sounds more like postponed.
Right, and actually further enrich the top 2% while yes. immiserating everybody else, and the ecological catastrophe just continues unabated. So,
Well, the problem, there are a couple of problems with that. One is, I mean, I can understand the temptation. I think it was Edmund Wilson who said after the 1929 crash, that it was just, there's something satisfying about seeing that gigantic fraud just come crashing down.
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand that feeling, but it would mean throwing scores of millions of people out of work. It would mean just immiserating a huge swath of the population. The unemployment rate hit 25% in 1932.
But isn't that where the demand for the New Deal came from? The potentially revolutionary circumstances brought about concessions from the ruling elites?
Yeah, at that point, though, we actually had a left in the United States, and a lot of the people in the Roosevelt administration were capable of, there was a whole different ideological and institutional realm back then. Now, there is no left in this country, and, we did well, and we moved in a better direction in the 1930s, but you can't say the same of Europe. Europe went crazy fascist, and there's a lot of evidence that economic downturns are actually better for the right than the left, because people get scared and lash out against the weak. So, I mean, look at what's going on now with all the anti-immigrant feeling mm-hmm. that's spreading around the United States and throughout Western Europe. A bad economy scares people and intensifies their competitive and ugly instincts. So I'm not sure that if the economy crashed, it would have fallen into our arms. It could have taken a very, very nasty direction. And I think that the combination of that risk plus the fact that we would have thrown 20 or 30 or 40 million people out of work and created vast hunger and homelessness, I think that's the reason that I didn't want to see a thing come crashing down. You can make the argument that it's actually better times that raises people's expectations and makes them more demanding of better of improvements. The 1960s were a time of a very strong economy that led to all kinds of popular upsurges. The orthodox policymakers like to run a little unemployment because they like to keep people a little scared.
But Joseph Stiglitz,
if things are too good, they start getting too demanding. We had the same thing in the late 1990s when the unemployment rate broke below 4%. That was the time when Seattle happened. It's a time when there's a whole mobilization, popular mobilization, around globalization and trade and finance issues that we haven't seen, hadn't seen before or since. So
I've heard
I'm
that.
Not
well,
sure that
well caller,
really
we have another caller online, so we're going to move to our next caller.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
All right,
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And you're listening to More Talk Radio. This is Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We're speaking with Doug Inwood. And this is your opportunity, if you've got questions about our economic state or our Social Security, to give them a call, 503-231-8187. We have about 10 minutes. Good morning. You're on the air.
This is Annalisa again. I need to take some issue with somebody calling Barack Obama a scoundrel. I think this man was caught up in a maelstrom that is so deep. The corruption is so deep and so hard to untangle that I think it was impossible for him to immediately start making changes, although I am vastly disappointed in some of the policy, and especially with these invasions and war efforts. But hardly I would ever call him a scoundrel. He is an honest, sincere person. Most of what I have seen of him, he's not lazy, which is one of the worst things that you can encounter when somebody is too lazy to try. So no, I still admire him and have respect for him, and I need to protect him from. And even what if he was a Muslim? The religious fervor in this country is unbelievable.
Annalisa, we didn't call him scoundrels.
We were just saying
that people won't call the ones who should be called scoundrels and have no problem calling the other folks.
Right.
But thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
Well, I think our last caller reflects something I would like your thoughts about in terms of the American political mindset.
Yeah.
In terms of one caller mentioned, you know, the affection people have for certain political figures. So you had a people who adored President Bush. You had people who hated President Bush. You had people who adore Obama and people who hate President Obama. And I'm wondering whether our emphasis on personality prevents us from doing a deeper analysis of the system we live in.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, you can. There's a great deal of continuity in American life, regardless of which, as a friend of mine once put it, which set of snouts is at the trough. You get pretty much an awful lot of continuity. So Bush was an extreme version of Republican philosophy in a lot of ways. But, you know, look, Obama is continuing the wars that he started. He continued the TARP. He continued an awful lot of the same policies. He's continuing the same policies on surveillance, wiretapping. Guantanamo is not closed. Bagram is still open. So, despite the change in personalities and style, there's an awful lot of continuity. There's this whole structure, all these structures of American life that tend towards perpetuating the status quo. And it's very, very hard to break out of that. You know, we can get excited about one personality or other, but we find that underneath the surface of the personalities, it's the same old thing. You know, you can look back in the 19th century, and we had similar things going on. We had two parties that were both dominated by business interests. There were certain regional and sectoral distinctions between them, but they were both dominated by business interests, and they were deeply corrupt. We had Wall Street and a bunch of corporate titans running things, buying influence in Washington with lots and lots of money, and you know, that was true 100 years ago, and it's true today. Sometimes it's tempting to say that really nothing has changed in American life over the last 100 years. Obviously, that's not true, but sometimes you read history, and it's tempting to believe that. But you know, people get so excited about whatever the personality or flavor of the month is that they overlook that.
You're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We've got time for maybe one or two more calls. That could be you at 503-231-8187. So in sum, what we're doing is we're experiencing what I call not only a shell game, which assets and finances are kind of being moved around in little hidden cups, such as where's our Social Security going to be? Who's trying to access it? How safe is it? And then also the fact that we're not getting a lot of substantive conversation about what people are really going to do about the economy. There's a lot of talk about, well, we'll have more jobs. We'll try to protect education. But nothing really serious is being said. What kind of questions should we be asking our politicians, our candidates who are running at a local level and at maybe a regional and state level?
Well, I think the questions would be, excuse me, just getting over a cold, related to some of the things we've been talking about. For example, do you really think Social Security is going under? Do you really think we're facing seven decades of depression levels of economic growth? Do you think our national interest is served by sending drone attacks over Pakistan? What do we gain by that? You can ask them those sorts of questions rather than I don't know what it is they ask them now. You know, what kind of underwear you wear or whatever. I mean, that's what the debates are like. The debates, such as they are, look like circuses. You've got Rand Paul and whoever's running against him in Kentucky. You have this the Tea Party candidate in Delaware who doesn't know what's in the First Amendment.
Yes,
it's just the level of debate would put, I think, a high school mock Congress to shame.
I think it does. Let's go to our last caller. Good morning, caller.
Thank you. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for a great discussion. According to a statistic that I read, 66% of corporations paid no income tax from 1998 to 2003. Do you know about this?
I don't know about that particular statistic, but certainly it seems like taxes have become optional for the elite.
The myth is that corporate profits increase investments and jobs, whereas corporations really buy back their own stock and speculate on foreign currency. Maybe one day, maybe recovery really depends upon overcoming this high-frequency trading and the tax havens.
Well, you know, the corporations are doing actually rather well, even though the rest of us are struggling in this economy. Corporate profits have risen very, very dramatically, and while wages have gone nowhere, and in fact, the ratio of the increase in corporate profits to the ratio of increase to the rate of increase in wages is about 50-1 right now, and we have no comparable portion in our history when there was such a lopsided ratio between profit growth and wage growth. So the corporations have lots and lots of money; they're just not spending it, they're not investing, and they're not hoarding. they're just hoarding it. Passing along to their shareholders or taking over each other or playing games in the financial markets.
But, and the financial sector has to be shriveled. We have to face this too-big-to-fail reality if mm-hmm. there is going to be a recovery. Financial profits, I think, amount to 40% of all corporate profits. They used to be like 7%.
Yeah, the financial sector has just grown enormously. I mean, it started in the early 80s and has just continue with a few interruptions. There was an interruption around the 1987 stock market crash. There was an interruption in the early 90s, and then there was a big interruption when we had a 2007-2008 financial crisis. But they've pretty much recovered from that, and they're back to where they were before, and they're paying themselves giant bonuses.
Well, along the lines of what the caller's asking, Doug, if we are experiencing one of the greatest gaps between profit and wages, and most of us are suffering because we don't have a job yet, corporations have been making massive profits, why is it that the ordinary person seems to have an issue with some of the groups who are out and protesting for higher wages, whether they be public workers or whether they be corporate workers? It seems as though folks are afraid to vote in wage increases.
Well, that's true. I mean, the public employees now, of course, are the everyone's favorite target. The teachers are now everyone's favorite target.
Right.
Education reform, it's a disgrace. But there's this, I don't know, a very broad section of the public thinks that because people who work in the private sector have crummy wages and benefits, that has somehow is the norm, and the public sector workers who have decent wages and benefits, they should be brought down to the level of private sector workers instead of having private sector brought up to the public sector level. The American public has a very primitive level of political thinking, and they really can't think systemically or in any kind of complicated way. And I find it immensely depressing. It makes me despair that everything could ever get better. But, you know, it would be nice to tax away some of those corporate profits and upper income, all those upper bracket incomes, and spend that on public benefit. And that would both promote economic growth and human welfare.
And we'd have an educated populace, but then we'd probably be really scary to the ruling classes.
Yes, they like us passive and ignorant. I think that's really what it comes
down to. Yeah, that's what it comes down to.
Yep.
We have time for just one more call, really briefly. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, the person that was complaining about Obama being called a scoundrel, I'm not sure if I'm qualified to say if he's a scoundrel or not, but the people running his campaign, namely Zbigniew Brzezinski running his presidential campaign, I know he's a scoundrel. So if he's backing him, all the people that are, as far as I look at it, the whole thing is just a big dog and pony show. It's all smoke and mirrors, and they just want this endless war machine. And Dwight David Eisenhower is right on his farewell address when he said, beware of the unwarranted influences of his original speech actually said, Congressional Military Industrial Complex, but his political handlers told him to leave out the word congressional because they didn't want to get too many people PO'd. But, the bottom line is that that's all they want is a continuous war machine and get rid of the middle class, and so he may be a scoundrel. Who knows?
Okay, thank you for your call.
Yeah.
We've been speaking with Doug Henwood, who is the editor of Left Business, Less left Business Observer, and also the host of a weekly radio program on WBAI in New York. Mr. Hinwood, your program is on which day?
It's on Thursdays at 5, but it's also archived on the web at my website, leftbusinessobserver.com, so people can hear, listen to it anytime on the web. Lots of material there, lots of interviews, lots of commentary.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for spending time with us, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk with you sometime in the future and maybe see what happens post-election.
Okay, anytime.
All righty, and we'll make sure to post your links. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. Stay tuned at 9 o'clock is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and more coming your way.